We're moving from the 20th century to the 18th to 19th centuries. So we're moving backwards and talking about odes and invocation. Well, not odes, but invocation. So I think a good way to, like, lead out is, like, invoking something forth.
Indeed.
Indeed. Yeah. Get to read the prelude.
Whatever you did, New Jerusalem.
Yes! And the prelude is, oh my gosh, I totally changed what I was thinking of doing because of your class this morning. The beginning of the prelude is so connected to Revelation and also to Milton, to the idea of, like, creating a new, like, what is the earth, creating a new earth or a new way of being. That this is, like, exactly the kind of question that Wordsworth is grappling with. Yeah. Even to the, like, down to the question of the city and what the city is. Yeah.
Interesting. That romantic era stuff makes you think, you know, Rousseau and what they were struggling with at that time.
Totally.
Romantic image of the noble savage, you know.
That's
attempted to. We still use that phrase to not romanticize indigenous people.
Like, absolutely. Right? And there's Wordsworth and The World Is Too Much With Us. Late and soon, he basically bemoans not having the pagan worldview. And so that's where he's like, getting and spending, we waste our powers, little we see in nature that is ours. So it's like the city, the economy, like way economy functions. We've given our hearts away. We are out of tune. And then he says, basically, like, by the end, he's like, if only I were a pagan, sucking us on a crude creed for a creed outworn, so might I, standing on this something, have sight of, wait. Like, basically, he's like, why can't I see Proteus with his horn? Yeah.
There's a line in the Adney Dillard book I've been listening to, The Living, where, you know, it's covering this period from the 1850s, now it's up to the 1890s in Bellingham Bay, right here. And when they start off, they're just wilderness pioneers trying to survive, and by now, there's telegraph, and there's newspapers, and there's streetcars, and this one guy who, for reasons I don't get into, thinks his life may be coming to an end, but he's not that old. But he's had an adult life where he's done what people there do, land speculation and trying to raise money. And there's a phrase, this isn't exactly it, but she says, and he realized he'd burrowed down into the scheme of things.
Wow.
Like he found himself caught up in all
the
news and what the world was telling him was important from outside, you know, Wall Street
totally.
And all the stuff that was otherwise so far away because even when the Civil War was waging, it wasn't waging in Bellingham Bay, you know.
Yeah.
They skipped all that. It wasn't even a state.
Totally. Right? That's so interesting.
So wasn't there a war.
Yeah, right.
They were just trying to raise families and survive.
Right, which is always my sense growing up in Seattle. That the Civil War, it was only until I moved to the East Coast that I realized how important the Civil War really was to America.
And of course the whole question of Oregon Territory was involved and, you know, would it be slave, you know, like who would get to decide and all that stuff. But these people were not involved in all that.
Okay.
Well, I guess we're going to start a little late today, aren't we?
I'm assuming.
It just is what it is.
Yeah,
right?
How many people are going to be coming from that group?
She said to me before I sent her my
tradition. Which I love the rhythm of life.
So do you think I should do with this?
I'm eclectic. But that's the dimension of it. Yes, the desolation of consolation is from that. Yes.
That's going to do it. It's a little hyphen.
What are you teaching next week?
Creation.
I just took
stories.
A little loop
on. Oh, neat.
Genesis,
various
first,
third
Genesis 1 and 2 in the first stage.
Tom's the kind of guy who's going to tell you read every word in the Bible.
Oh, no,
I'm
not going to do that.
it's rich.
Not a student. Wow,
it's got a lot of stuff in it, but its language is the needs of people. It's a little attention.
I haven't looked for a long time. I really haven't. Not since, yeah.
That's a nice segue, huh?
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for being here on Friday afternoon. It's so beautiful out. So thank you for being here. So we're talking about Poetry of the Elements. I'm Kate Thorpe. I think I've met all of you now, though. I'm a poet, a PhD student at Princeton, writing about personification in 18th century poetry. So I'm thinking a lot about relationships between humans and nature in my work. And it's been so much fun this week to be talking about poetry and going outside and writing poems about nature and being so much closer to nature here than I am in kind of like in my mind in my library carrel on the seafloor of the basement, the library. It's been wonderful to learn from you and your perspectives on these poems and just seeing them in totally new ways. And having conversations feel just completely, it's just been so life-giving and exciting and nurturing, and nourishing. So thank you. And I'm really excited that we have one more class and one more afternoon to think about poems. So as some of you know, I shifted around the particular subjects of our focus. So I decided to focus on fire on Wednesday instead of today because it was a little bit longer of a, it just needed its own day, I felt. And earth and air, I feel like are in kind of conversation with each other. And one way I thought it might be interesting to think about that is through one poet. So on Monday and Wednesday, we read two different poets who are, in each case, really different from each other, and kind of in different ways. And all of those poets were 20th century poets. And I thought for today, let's move backwards in time. And we're going to read two poems by William Wordsworth, who was a romantic poet. Does anyone not?
Yes.
Yeah. So who can tell me something? Who can tell me something about Wordsworth? Like, what do you know about Wordsworth?
I flash upon my immortal eye a host of golden daffodils.
Yeah, I memorized it in nature. He lived in the Lake District of England, and he was a postal carrier. He carried letters, I think, to earn a living, sort of.
At least some of the time. Yep, definitely.
And his sister might have written a lot of his poetry. But I don't want to get into all of
that. And this is really interesting, that we tend to think, like, Wordsworth gets a really bad rap for being kind of like this egotistical sublime, which Keats, I think, coined, I can't actually remember, but it's like a, description, like a later romantic description of Wordsworth as being kind of egotistical. But, and yet, that's all always really complicated with Wordsworth, the story. He had a really close relationship with his sister, and they spent all of this time walking through the Lake District together. And with his friend Coleridge, and in his poem Tintern Abbey, at the very end, he turns to his sister and invokes her. And so it's very much his poems and the ethos of the first generation of the romantic poets is very much about conversation and about friendship and about connection and relationship. And relationship with other people and with nature. And these things are always in really close connection and harmony. So people accuse him, right, of being the poet who gets the fame. But he's very much, in his own writing, and my understanding, my sense of his life is that he's also closely connected to her. And she lives with him even when he gets married, that they're, closely connected, and her journals, he does use phrases from her journals in his poems, like in the Daffodils poem. It's a real question with Wordsworth, and I think it's never quite, I think it's like you can't quite settle it. I think it's kind of it's a vexed thing. And there were lots of vexed things about Wordsworth and his relationships with other people and women and also with nature. And that's one of the things that I actually really love about him. I think he's really interesting.
But he did live close to nature.
Yes, yes.
You can't deny that.
Yes, and he was very politically active in protecting the Lake District against tourism. And so he was writing poems, arguing for a return to nature. But also politically, like politically engaged in protecting this area, which had become a really important tourist destination. So he's very much involved in this turn away from city life, turn away from 18th century like jargon and artificial tropes, personification, which is like what my project is all about. He basically eschews personification because it's artificial and it's all part of civilization and culture, and he wants to return to nature. It's a more complicated question than that. But anyway, it's like he's part of, so it's a very similar, I thought he's really interesting too because it's part of a similar story in terms of the religion of empire versus creation. Okay, so all that to say that I'm really excited to talk about Wordsworth.
No kidding.
Can just to make sure everyone knows each other, can we just do a really quick round of introductions and just if you have experience with poetry in the past, if you have a favorite poem or poet, or not, that's also totally fine, but just a little introduction.
I'm Peg, and my poetry experience is very little, but I enjoy it a lot when I get to try my hand at it.
I'm Wes, and I had more fun this week with poetry than I can remember any other time.
I'm Tom, and I'm here today from Issaquah, and I've done very little in the realm of poetry, and if I had to name a favorite poet, I think it would be progressive rock musician and vocalist John Anderson of Yes, because I view his lyrics as poetry.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm Sue, and I write poetry much, as I've said, for other people to read, but I write it sometimes for myself or occasionally for one of my children. And kind of weirdly enough, my favorite poets have been the ones that you have engaged this week, you know, so it's, yeah, and I love Wordsworth. He's been one of my favorite romantics, so, yeah.
I'm Richard. I've read poetry most of my life, at least, as I came of age and from college, and I love Wordsworth, but I don't read a lot of them much anymore, but there's one poem that comes into my mind, She Was a Phantom of Delight. Isn't that one of
I think that's from one of the Lucy poems.
The what?
I think that's one of, he has these famous, a set of famous poems about this very mysterious
girl, Lucy. It was used at a funeral of a famous lady within our extended family once, and it's rarely used, but it's a very unique poem. And, you know, She Was a Phantom of Delight describes a woman, I don't know who's describing particularly, but, you know, I'm a romantic at heart anyway, and so I respond to the romantic poets. And like Wordsworth.
Great.
And others.
Fantastic, thank you. Okay, so let's, I have actually two packets because I changed my mind last minute today after coming to the Bible study this morning about what to read.
I thought we were going to do Earth today.
We are, wait, what did I say? We're doing Wind and Earth.
Okay,
yes, we're doing Wind and Earth, that's right.
Okay.
Yep, and so I'm giving you two things. One is the beginning of Wordsworth's epic poem, The Prelude. That's the thing that I've added. And then this packet that has on the first page a Wordsworth poem called We Are Seven, which is from Lyrical Ballads, which is his first collection in 1798 that he published again, like collectively, with his friend Coleridge. And then there are a couple of other examples which we're not going to talk about today, but I give to you as wonderful examples of engaging with wind, as a kind of odes and this apostrophe approach. Okay, so I have the hardest time figuring out which to start with, because, yeah, there are good reasons for doing both. But since it's 4:15, let's make sure I really want to make sure we get to the prelude, so let's start there.
The one that's called the prelude.
Yeah. Let me just get my sentence about this. No, I actually want to start with We Are Seven, and then end at the prelude, and then we'll do our exercise. Okay, so So, Lyrical Ballads. Has anyone heard of that book? Lyrical Ballads. Yeah, it's not as well known. It's Wordsworth's first book of poems, and it he wrote it in conjunction with his friend Coleridge, also a famous Romantic poet, and it as part of a movement to write poetry that's directly to people, like common people, and about common people. And many of the poems, he wrote a famous preface as part of in the 1800 edition. So it had 1802. And there was a famous, he wrote a famous preface that's a kind of a proclamation. It really creates modern poetry as we know of it. It's a really important document where he argues against artificial poetry as being a kind of artificial form of speech. And instead, he wants to write in the language of flesh and blood. To people in language they can understand in ways that excite them and move readers. A lot of these poems are based on his experience walking around the countryside, literally talking to people. And he has these conversations with people. They're in the form of ballads. Does anyone know about ballad? What's a ballad?
Well, in one way, it's a song.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a song. The Troubadours, it's a song and story.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, so they're in this form that, like, a lot of repeated rhymes, a much more simple form than, like, say, Pindaric odes or even sonnets, much more direct, but a kind of low, lower cultured form. Than a high culture form would be. So it's a really, really intentional decision to write. And then he calls it lyrical ballad. So he's merging the tradition of the lyric with the tradition of the ballad. What are your associations of lyric?
The obvious, like song words?
Yes, yep, song. It's definitely from the Greek, connected to song, the lyre. Becomes associated with emotion, the voice, and with elevated poetry. It's a complex term because it then becomes appropriate and connected to the Romantic poets as this kind of lyric expression of emotion and subjectivity. But it's associated with a kind of like poetic expression of the self in some way. It's a kind of hybrid collection. It's really weird. I say all of that because to our mind, this might not seem weird, but it really is in terms of that time and place. Like, it's really innovative. Okay, so it looks kind of long, but it actually reads very quickly. I'd like to just go around the room and start, and each person read three stanzas. So we read the whole poem together. Does that sound okay? Mm-hmm. Cool. Who would like to start? Yeah. Okay. Do you want to start?
I'll start.
Perfect.
Three stanzas. Okay.
Yeah.
A simple child, your brother Jim, that lightly draws its breath and feels its life in every limb, what should it know of death? I met a little cottage girl. She was 8 years old, she said. Her hair was thick with many a curl that clustered round her head. She had a rustic woodland air, and she was wildly clad. Her eyes were fair and very fair. Her beauty made me glad.
Sisters and brothers, little maid, how many may you be? How many? 7 in all, she said, and wondering looked at me. And where are they, I pray you tell? She answered, 7 are we. And 2 of us at Conway dwell, and 2 are gone to sea. 2 of us in the churchyard lie, my sister and my brother. And in the churchyard cottage, I dwell near them with my mother.
You say that 2 at Conway dwell, and 2 are gone to sea. Yet you are 7, I pray you tell, sweet maid, how this may be. Then did the little maid reply, 7 boys and girls are we. 2 of us in the churchyard lie beneath the churchyard tree. You run about, my little maid, your limbs, they are alive. If 2 are in the churchyard laid, then ye are only 5.
Their graves are green, they may be seen, the little maid replied. 12 steps or more from my mother's door, and they are side by side. My stockings there I often knit, my kerchief there I hem, and there upon the ground I sit and sing to them. And often after sunset, sir, when it is light and fair, I take my little porringer and eat my supper there.
The first that died was little Jane. In bed she moaning lay, till God released her of her pain, and then she went away. So in the churchyard she was laid, and all the summer dry, together round her grave we played, my brother John and I. And when the ground was white with snow, and I could run and slide, my brother John was forced to go, and he lies by her side.
How many are you then, said I, if they two are in heaven? The little maiden did reply, O master, we are seven. But they are dead, those two are dead, their spirits are in heaven. 'Twas throwing words away, for still the little maid would have her will, and said, Nay, we are seven. So what is the situation here that Wordsworth sets up? It's like, what literally is happening here?
A wildly clad little girl.
Yeah.
And it really struck me, like, wildly clad, but I still have no idea what she was clad in.
Yeah, totally. Really, but wildly, such an important word. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great. So there's this girl, and who else is here?
Well, he's having a conversation with her.
Yeah.
They're to just.
Yep.
Explain to it.
So there's a speaker. There's a poetic speaker. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this I. Like, it's in the I perspective.
Yeah, which person?
Is this Wordsworth? How do we have any, like...
Well, does Wordsworth have a brother named Jim? Like, in the first line?
Yeah.
He's relaying this story to his brother Jim.
So, information that we have about the speaker. We know that he's talking to someone else. Mm. So he's in a conversation with someone else reporting on what happened. What else do we know about the speaker?
He's very inquisitive about this girl's family.
He doesn't leave her alone.
He's not buying it.
He's totally not buying it. Right. That's great. What isn't he buying?
Well, her committedly saying that there's seven of her and her siblings.
Yeah.
And she goes on to explain it's plain. Explain the two are laid in the graveyard, churchyard.
Mm-hmm. It's a problem of math.
Yes. About the sixth stanza, I said, wait a minute, something going on here. It's five and seven. What's happening?
Is happening? Why the disagreement? Mm.
Well, he counts five living ones, and she counts seven total.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's some stuff going on about death here. The different concepts of death, his and hers.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they may be beneath the churchyard tree, but they're certainly present.
And what does that mean, if they're beneath the churchyard tree? And for whom, too?
Well, for the little girl, her two siblings have passed on.
Yeah.
But she's still very present to them.
Right.
They're still very present to her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet, Jane's death is described, and then she went away. And John's death is described as he was forced to go.
Yeah.
So there's a sense that they're not here, in her own words.
Right.
And yet, they are here.
Yeah.
She could have said they died, but she said they went away.
Totally. Yeah, and went away from where to where.
Mm-hmm. Even while she insists that they're right here.
Yeah. So that leads me to my core question is, what is the status of the earth here?
The status of
the earth. Mm-hmm. What is the status of the earth?
It's almost like holder of living spirits.
Mm. Okay, yeah.
Their graves are green.
Yeah, that, I've admitted that you're less fresh.
Yeah.
Recent.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that's totally accurate.
What are other interpretations? Absolutely, that could totally be one. Yeah.
Full of life.
Fresh.
Verdant.
Life. Verdant. So there's a way in which she's substituting the greenness of the grave, like the greenness of the grass or of nature. Mm. She's substituting that for the living limbs of a person. So basically he says, like this third line, like a simple child that lightly draws its breath and feels its life in every limb, what should it know of death? And so she's basically saying that the life of limbs is not, she can't see a separation between that and the greenness of the earth. Like it's not even a metaphor to her. Like we might think about the greenness of the earth as a metaphor for life, but it's not even metaphorical.
Right.
It's like, that's why she won't accept the speaker's idea that they actually are dead. We can read them as, we could read them in other ways, but no, we have to know that there's a literal meaning here. There's a literal truth. And she just won't buy it. No, I have. Like,
well, she
knows
exactly where they are.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
They're exactly 12 steps from the door.
Right. Yeah.
Who knows more about death? Where is it?
She spends time.
Yeah.
She sings to them, and so they're really present to her.
Great. Go ahead.
I know you've drawn us back to the beginning. I hadn't noticed this the first time. But it almost strikes me that the story he tells, starting the second stanza, is meant to illustrate the question he's asking. Mm. You know, it's a little child shouldn't know of death.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? I mean, in a world that's proper or correct, a little child shouldn't know of death. And then he tells the story that, you know, addresses that question.
Great. Absolutely. Yeah. That's really interesting. So does she know death or doesn't she know death?
She uses the word, I mean, the first that died,
mm-hmm.
She's not completely euphemistically avoiding it,
yep.
You know?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, she's not saying they're right here, she's saying they're under the tree.
Yeah.
You know, she's not saying, I don't think I see them.
I think the prepositions are really weird here, really important, and kind of like following off of what you're saying, Peg, about how precise she is,
mm-hmm.
about where they are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if we could take a minute and if you could just circle prepositions.
Starting where? With her,
yeah,
with her speech?
Yeah, start with her speech on line 21.
Yeah, there's...
Or actually 18.
Prepositions.
Yeah, like words that suggest location.
I just saw something that I had not noticed before. Thank you.
pause there. What have you discovered? Like, what prepositions came up?
I noticed in the churchyard is four times.
Wow. Yeah.
If I counted right, I may have missed one.
Yeah.
And I also noticed in relation to that, that she says present tense, in the churchyard lie, mm-hmm. twice. Then he says, if two are in the churchyard laid, mm-hmm. past tense.
Yeah.
But then when she describes what's past for her, what had happened down in 53, so in the churchyard was she laid. So for her, the laid was past, but now it's present lie.
So there's this question, this uncertainty of past, present, living, dead, above, beneath, possibly.
Well, what made me sort of go, oh, was when, and I realized when I read it though later, but two of us in the churchyard lie, and she, I believe she's talking about them as a collective. Mm-hmm. But when I read it, it almost felt like, you know, she was considering herself part of everything that was.
Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that?
I'm not sure. But it just feels to me like she's not making it a lot of distinctions. Mm. Like there's a porous moving in and out.
Yeah, that two of us, that it's all apart.
Right.
Rather than separating out.
Yeah, there's no individuals in her mind.
Right. Yeah. Versus five. Five are left. Okay, this is our family. Those are gone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, she's got them all accounted for. Two are in Conway. Two are gone to sea. Two are in the churchyard. And then there's she.
Yeah.
I mean, it all works out.
So there is. Mm-hmm. So there is a math. There is a logic.
The math figures out. He's the one questioning it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very apparent to her.
Right.
That they're all accounted for.
They're all accounted for. Right. She's close.
Right.
Well, she seems to be closer to the ones whose graves are green even than the other ones. We don't know that. I think they're all close, but we don't know that anyway.
Well, I mean, it makes me think a little bit about mysticism. And Sue, you're reminding us that this isn't woo-woo, that, like, we're not somewhere up here removed in the clouds, that, like, she's not distinguishing, she's not cutting up her family. She's, like, there's a poor, I love that word, porous. And there's a math, there's a logic to it.
Yeah.
And an accounting, it's a kind of accounting in its own right. And
it makes me ask the question, who knows more about death, the 8-year-old girl or the the narrator?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Things are getting turned around pretty quickly here, which I find to be very intriguing.
And following what you're saying, Richard, it's the narrator who twice says they're in heaven.
Uh-huh.
She does not, that's
oh,
not
yeah.
her thing.
She's not God.
He says, if the two are in heaven, and he says, their spirits are in heaven.
Let's move up, and she's like, no, like,
they're in the earth.
Yeah, in the earth.
In the earth, right.
Yeah.
It so strikes me that certainly, you know, in really apprehending the truest reality, which holds both the real, they have the past, they are not here, and they are here, both. And that second naivete that oftentimes, you know, comes out of a lot of what the Romantic poets write, mm-hmm. where you come into an understanding that is really more childlike and more wise, and most of us really resist moving into the wisdom of what's called the second naivete, because it's, I don't want to be like a child. Well, what does Jesus say?
Yeah.
You know, then really, before we're deformed, we understand things. We can hold that together without, that's just what we perceive. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of stuff gets categories and logic overrides everything else.
Right.
And
Right.
Well, that being able to hold that with confidence as both those things are true. Yeah.
I'm not sure I see any other exclams, but when he's like ready to pull his hair out, he says, but they are dead. Those two are dead. Exclam. Their spirits are in heaven. Exclam.
Yeah, how do you not see this?
I mean, it's like,
it's so obvious. He's just throwing words away.
And following up on Sue's point, he shows himself unwilling to change. Like, she'll have her will. Yeah. I'm wasting my word trying to convince her that he's mansplaining to her.
As well as adult splitting.
Yeah, so there's this split. We see the split between the adult and the child logic, Sue's saying. And so I'm curious, how is Wordsworth setting up this poem? Like, how is he offering this?
Can I ask you a question from your expertise? Okay. How important in his context would be that it's a girl, the gender issue?
Important. I think really important.
Mm. Would her witness otherwise seem less valid than a boy's at the same age?
Otherwise it would seem less valid than a boy's. So he chooses not just a child, but a girl. And who's wildly clad. Just a country, like a girl, and who's poor.
Someone you have to trust.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not appropriately dressed.
This is after Rousseau, and this is after Thomas Gray's Ode on the Distant Prospect of Eton College, where he separates out adults from children. Like, there's already this very clear logic of adults having this kind of knowledge that children can't have, and that's experience that's painful. And even horrifying in the Eton College Ode. Like, it's really awful. And the children are protected in this innocent world. But the children, their protection they don't perceive the world they're in. That's what, it's a completely isolated kind of protection. And it's boys, right? It's Eton College that he's, the speaker from a distance is observing. And he, like, basically by the end, he has these malicious personifications that are going to attack the boys. They're just waiting for them to grow up. And Rousseau idealizing or emphasizing children and childhood and nature. So there's definitely this structure already in place to separate out a child logic from an adult logic. And yet Wordsworth is doing something really different with that. The child here is a girl, and she speaks. She has her own account of how this, and it's a different kind of knowledge. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah,
he's definitely building off of something, but also really reworking it by having a girl, and having her be not idealized or something. Yeah.
Oh, I don't want to derail you, but how autobiographical is this? I note in the footnote that his own mother died when he was 8 and the age of the girl in the poem. So is he recreating something out of his subconscious?
I don't know that we can say that directly. I don't know that we can really know.
That's a contextual question.
He definitely, so we're going to turn in just a minute to the Prelude, which is his own autobiography.
Okay.
And there he describes his mother's death. A little bit, and people have argued that the death of his mother, this trauma, is really, he has this fear, all of these weird scenes of death in this poem, of like coming across dead people, dead bodies. In his poems, there are these weird moments of death becoming a kind of point of the uncanny. And people argue it has to do with his childhood trauma, but like, we don't really know.
Could he be speaking through the 8-year-old girl in this, as well as being the protagonist?
This is
the same
a great
time?
Question. So to come back to this question of who is the speaker here, and what is Wordsworth? How is Wordsworth helping us to relate to the speaker versus the child? Who do we empathize with? What effect might this have on adult readers? Like, they're not children. These are adults who are reading. He's writing the language, he's a man speaking to men, so it's very male, as he's repurposing this form of the lyric. He's repurposing this form from a feminine world of lots of female poets in the 18th century, and so there's lots of writing about that. It's very intentionally a man speaking to men and adults, and shifting what could he be shifting here? Like, how does that seem to be working? The relationship of the reader to the speaker to the girl. How would you think about that? It was a really long question, really long-winded.
Well, he pulls my focus almost immediately to the girl.
Great.
I mean, I'm not identifying with him. She's more interested in what she says.
Yeah. Okay, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. What would if he just had the girl and didn't have the speaker in the poem? Then what would that affect? How would that be different?
There wouldn't be the opportunity to allow the girl to say it over and over and insist on it. And this presentation of his, you know, like rigid logic, concrete interpretation of things.
Yeah, great. Like, what might we say is
the tension would be gone.
The tension. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What might we say as readers if we had this girl just saying that her there upon the ground, I sit and sing to them, I eat my supper there.
Oh, she's just a child, I mean, a fantasy.
Condescending.
Not going to
be naive.
By the end, we believe her.
Right.
So how does the speaker, it's weird that there's, how does the speaker serve this function of helping us?
By being,
in a new way.
I think it's his, like I was saying before, like he's being very rigid and stuck in his head and quote logical, and by he doesn't shift at all. He just keeps banging that drum of that rigid concrete interpretation drum.
She also talks a lot about life things, like upon the ground I sit after sunset, light and fair. The churchyard, around the grave. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just kind of get the idea that, I mean, she kind of builds this, she's very much involved in the living.
I couldn't help but hear in the stanza, and when the ground was white with snow, and I could run and slide, and then the sled came down and knocked Peg over and broke her leg. Because it doesn't say how John died.
Yes, you can put yourself right in this poem.
I might have to change that. But
so, I had this.
Go ahead.
I had this thought. This thought that the narrator is kind of like being. Keeps himself like very black and white, and the girl is full of vibrant color, and so he's providing this huge opportunity for the contrast, for the girl to come off as this beautiful, flowering, colorful, expressive, creative being, and he's playing the role of mundane, boring, gray.
Yeah, she's beautiful. Eyes fair, very fair beauty.
But we can, but can't we relate to him too?
And especially the readers, perhaps, if they are men.
Yeah.
And so recognizing as a reader your voice and the one who is rigid and, keeps things within a way too small container and is kind of dry and repetitive and not teeming with life, not expansive. I think since that would be the typical reader, that if you're identifying with that voice being your perspective, and then there's this convicted and beautiful portrayal of being in touch with the earth and not being willing to.
There's a lot of surprise here.
I'm surprised, in terms of how he's wielding these different roles and different.
I'm wondering also, can fill in, about, of course, not surprising I would ask, I suppose, but of the religious context, given the churchyard is mentioned over and over and over again, he says heaven. There's no mention of God, there's no mention of any actual religion. The churchyard is just this place, and they live right next to it. So there's this church space that's there, sort of implying, in my mind, but maybe I'm wrong in the context, all of what the church is, including its doctrines and dogmas and all the stuff that gives him his answer, well, their spirits are in heaven.
But
there's nobody speaking for the church exactly, or representing that.
It's a really good question. Yeah.
The girl mentions God.
I'd like to actually address that indirectly.
Oh, she does. She does.
She does, but not the God.
Yeah, Tom points out that she mentioned God. That's right. I
do think the rigid doctrine of heaven, is being questioned, as you suggested. I think that's totally clear. I think. I could give a biographical answer, but I'd actually rather turn to the prelude.
And does it, one last thing, does it matter? Is it spirits and not souls?
That's a really good question. Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know enough about the context.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So their spirits are, I mean, I don't, I mean, I think it's not a matter of the context so much as it is of the question of doctrine. I mean, souls would place it more in the doctrinal realm. Does that seem right? Versus spirits is a little bit more like, I mean, maybe it is a context question, because thinking about his other poems, which have, like, there's this other girl figure called Lucy, which I mentioned before, who's kind of like a spirit. Sometimes it's actually not clear if she's a real girl or if she's the wind. In fact, we could have used that poem. And so there's a way in which spirit also captures, Wordsworth writes about pagans every so often, like bemoaning the difference in the world now and like wishing nostalgically that he could have this mindset of a pagan, that could see life in nature, in the moon, in the sea. And spirit captures, like, allows for a more open approach to what, to like life that's not physical.
I don't know
than
what
soul might. So that's just my, I'm just speculating. No,
yeah, actually. I don't know what his biblical knowledge would be, but as
very, very strong. I would think
spirit.
And, yeah, oh my gosh. And that's where we're going to go to the prelude,
and
we will
spirit
see that.
Spirit is
yeah.
a biblical word, but soul is not. I mean, some modern translations use soul. I'm not sure King James,
that's
I assume,
so
what he would have at that time.
And he was, you know, Anglican, educated at Cambridge. He became increasingly, this is a really, really early poem, he became increasingly doctrinaire and conservative over the course of his life, so critics argue that, like, his later poems aren't as interesting. I think that's a really complicated issue and question, but here he's, like, less conservative, less doctrinal, that's really clear. Yeah. Okay.
It's very interesting that the even though they have gone away, have died, the physical, I mean, you definitely have a sense that she physically apprehends the reality.
Yes.
So, but it's not like the soul is a separate, you know.
Yes.
So that it is an ongoing, you know, physicality and presence that transcends and yet has changed. And she just kind of knows this. Obviously, she's witnessing to that. It's her experience. And that's clearly, as the reader, overriding the doctrinal, but no, this is the party line kind of thing.
Yeah.
And when you read this, who are you going to believe? You know, it's pretty obvious.
The physical experience.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, when talking, which I'd forgotten my sister, but I wonder if he is bringing forth the female experience that his sister did not have a platform for. And so he's somehow, that has transformed him, or awakened him to different possibilities, but then he is speaking forth out of his intimate relationship with her, has given him access to the female within him.
Interesting, yeah, absolutely.
And of course, if readers are supposed to have the footnote, it says, the little girl who is the heroine.
Yeah, I know. Footnotes are so funny sometimes. And I think
that
footnotes.
Tip off, but I agree that.
Yeah, one of my advisors says that when there's a footnote, it's actually a sign that there's something really vexed going on. That, like, that's the place where you should press further rather than just trusting the footnote. It's like often the point where the editors are like, let's explain this away. Yeah. So I think that's really interesting that they're trying to, like, define.
But it's
same in the Bible.
Yeah.
It's not suggesting it's an editor. Right, it's his footnote.
Oh my gosh, you're totally right.
I met with
sorry
him.
About that. Yeah, totally right.
But then it shifts.
Yeah.
Right.
The last sentence is
says third person, and there's no quote marks.
Yeah, that's really weird.
Yeah.
Is this from a longer anthology? I'm gonna have to check on that. It's really odd.
And sometimes
Wordsworth's own explanatory notes actually do that overcompensated too. Even his notes are sometimes suspect. Where he's like, I want to explain away the weirdness of this.
Yeah.
The thorn is a really good one to look at. And also for women, and yeah. But we're not going to look at that right now. We're going to look at...
I have
at
one more observation.
Yeah, of course.
I was going to say that I think he's seeking to wake up his rigid male readers to see how they are boring and gray in contrast to the female child spirit that's, like, just wonderful and so refreshing to listen to.
Yeah, this awakening. And he talks about that in the preface, too. And it's especially in the preface as he's talking about an awakening. It's sense organs. So that's coming back to the physical experience. like teaching, basically enlivening latent sense organs that readers have. They're part of being human. And so he's basically helping readers to become more human. It's really with a humanity that he's not imposing on them, but he's awakening something that's already in their minds and then bodies, because it's a sensory experience that he's emphasizing. It's really interesting logic of how that awakening happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that, and we can see here, like, one strategy, kind of like slant strategy of conversation, yeah, and dialogue, and these characters.
Honestly raises the question of what is true, what is the truth, which
what
logic,
is the truth?
You know, claims to have, you know, that is the domain of truth, while this is, which is truth, and how do you apprehend it, and how is it manifest, and how do you name it? Yeah.
And that takes us beautifully into this passage from the Prelude.
Working hard to get it.
Keep at it. Teacher grabs the transition.
And ruin the class.
And ruin the class for sure.
We're not in your graduates, obviously.
It's great. It's so fascinating. I keep running over every day, so I'm very aware that I want to let you out for dinner, and I want to make sure we get outside. So which is the, what is the truth? How to apprehend it? The Prelude is a poem. It's this autobiography that Wordsworth wrote, a lyric. It's an epic autobiography. It's a totally new genre when he's writing this poem. He takes up Milton's epic. There really aren't many epics in the 18th century. There are mock epics. Pope writes a mock epic, the Dunciad. Mm-hmm. But Wordsworth really takes up Milton's epic of Paradise Lost and this form, and radically. So if Milton is writing about the Bible, Wordsworth is writing about himself. Mm-hmm. It's his own story. And it doesn't get published until after he dies. He writes it as a prelude to this other philosophical text that he feels like he's supposed to be writing, called The Recluse, that he and his friend Coleridge decide he should write as like a philosophical poet. He's going to make a name for himself as this capital P poet. And he gets horrible writer's block and can't write. And so instead what he does is he starts composing this thing about himself and his own experience, and always kind of like as the prelude to this other thing. So it's this really interesting one thing. I mean, it's like 12 books. It's long and talks about the French Revolution and lots of other things, but it's also about his own sense of vocation coming into being and his sense of coming back to this place. We grew up in the Lake District. Goes away, goes to Paris, is there during the French Revolution, comes back, and it's like a kind of a moment of return to home, to nature. And trying to grapple with exactly these questions of like, what is the false self, what is the true self? I hope that's not too much to overload onto this, but hopefully that's helpful context as we read this. So I just want to read the first like 54 lines. This is the very beginning. And he also writes it in multiple drafts. It's very fragmented, so it's all about like return and composition, and he's revising it for his entire life. He revises this poem. And this is part of the second iteration in 1804. So originally it had actually a different beginning, and he then incorporates this beginning into this once he's going back to revise it. So it's after the Lyrical Ballads book. Okay, so can we go around and read like maybe 10 lines each? And now we're shifting. There's still some earth in this, and I think it's actually a good way to end out the week, because we have earth, we have river, water, and we have wind. And wind is the beginning and the end of this passage. So if you could, as you listen, if you could pay particular attention to how wind comes in, how he talks about to the wind. But we'll get the other elements too. So we are seven. I was thinking about earth. I was thinking that would help us talk about earth, the role of earth, and now we're shifting to wind. Great. Let's see. Tom, would you like to begin?
Sure. Oh, there is blessing in this gentle breeze that blows from the green fields and from the clouds and from the sky. It beats against my cheek and seems half conscious of the joy it gives. Oh, welcome, messenger. Oh, welcome, friend. A captive greets thee, coming from a house of bondage, from yon city's walls set free, a prison where he hath been long immured. Now I am free, enfranchised and at large, may fix my habitation where I will.
What dwelling shall receive me, and what vale shall be my harbor? Underneath what grove shall I take up my home, and what sweet stream shall with its murmurs lull me to my rest? The earth is all before me, with a heart joyous, nor scarred at its own liberty.
Scared.
At its own liberty. I look about, and should the guide I choose be nothing better than a wandering cloud, I cannot miss my way. I breathe again, trances of thought and mountings of the mind come fast upon me. It's shaken off, as if by miraculous gift, to shaken off.
The brethren of my own unnatural self, the heavy weight of many a weary day, not mine, and such as were not made for me. Long months of peace, if such bold word accord, with any promises of human life. Long months of ease and undisturbed delight, and mine are in prospect, whither shall I turn, by road or pathway, or through open fields, or shall a twig or any floating thing upon the river point me out my course?
Enough that I am free. For months to come, may dedicate myself to chosen tasks, may quit the tiresome sea and dwell on shore, if not a settler on the soil, at least to drink wild water and to pluck green herbs and gather fruits fresh from their native bough. Nay more, if I may trust myself, this hour hath brought a gift that consecrates my joy.
For I, methought, while the sweet breath of heaven was blowing on my body, felt within a corresponding mild creative breeze, a vital breeze which traveled gently on o'er things which it had made, and is become a tempest, a redundant energy, vexing its own creation.
You know what, let's stop there, actually. I think that's good. Thank you all for reading. It's beautiful. Okay, so we don't have very much time. So I want to just highlight, if we can just quickly frame the beginning and end of this passage in terms of the wind. Amidst this context of the struggle that Wordsworth is having, what is this struggle? Do you get a sense of that? And this is actually a totally parallel struggle to the one that Sue and Wes have been highlighting in the Book of Revelation and the religion of the two different religions. So what is this, like, the burden of my own unnatural, by miraculous gift, has shaken off that burden of my own unnatural self, that heavy weight of many a weary day, not mine, and such as were not made for me.
I might not have gotten this if you hadn't shaped it for us, but given what you said, Kate, I'm hearing that as he's shedding the cultural form that he's been given to rediscover his natural form.
Yeah, so, welcome, friend, he says in line 6, a captive greets thee, coming from a house of bondage, from yon city's walls set free, a prison where he hath been long immured. Enough that I am free, enfranchised and at large, may fix my habitation where I will.
He's suddenly free from some kind of stuff he's been living under.
That's right.
Whether it's reputation or whatever, I don't know.
He's free from the city.
Well, kind of not, because then he's doing trances of thought and mountains of the mind. When your head plays
totally
games.
Oh my gosh, so he is in a vortex.
Yeah,
that's absolutely. And he keeps wanting to say it's shaken off, but the very fact that he says it shows that it's like.
That it's creeping in.
It's creeping in, yeah, exactly. And the whole first book of the Prelude, he's like in this movement back and forth. Yeah. So, and then this question of vocation. Like, here he is, back in the Lake District, free. But then it's like the question of, well, what happens? Like, what dwelling shall receive me? In what vale shall be my harbor? Underneath what grove shall I take up my home? So, like, all of these questions. Mm-hmm. like, okay, like, now here I am.
Yeah, I mean, the same questions that we have today, right? Yeah. I mean, the very same ones. Like, okay, I'm not on this clue bus anymore.
Right.
But yeah. All those choices are among various nature choices.
Yes.
The vale, the grove, the stream.
Yes.
The earth is before me, not the civilization is before me.
Yeah. And that he's taken directly from Milton, the very end of Paradise Lost. Mm. The earth was all before them. That's the like the last lines of Adam and Eve stepping out of the garden. So to say the earth is all before me here, when Woodruff is returning to nature, what do you make of that? Because you're right, Wes. Like all of the nouns here are nature. He is back in nature.
But it's interesting when he says that I may trust myself, have brought a gift that consecrates my joy. Yes, those are all the words we use today.
Yes, but, and consecrate. I thought that was such an interesting.
If you're in God's realm, that life is a gift. Everything is a gift and a joy, as opposed to.
Yeah. So that's a great segue, Peg, to the breeze. So he's in this vexation of torment and wanting to believe that here he's back and this is the right, this is the place of freedom, that long months of ease and undisturbed delight are mine in prospect. But then it's the question of whither shall I turn? By road or pathway? Or shall it twig or any floating thing upon the river? Point me out my course. Like, I don't know if that doesn't quite seem like predestination or like, you know, like how, like.
Well, on one hand, he's concerned about where it's going to end up. On the other, it doesn't matter. Shall it twig at the stream point where I'm going to go?
Totally.
He's free.
There's a freedom about that. Yeah, so true.
He's also anxious underneath that.
Yeah. So true.
As you're pointing it out, there's an outer breeze and an inner breeze.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So what is going on with these breezes?
Yes.
What is going on with these breezes? Yeah. So, there is blessing. So the first breeze, what is the first breeze?
Sweet breath of heaven, he says, blowing on my body.
Gentle, great. What else about the breeze when we first hear
from the sky?
And from the green fields and from the clouds. Mm-hmm. It's not just the sky. Like there's this wide, broad expanse of where this breeze is coming from. Yeah. And outside, external, it beats against my cheek and seems half conscious of the joy it gives. What do you make of that? Half-conscious.
For someone moving away from personification, there, he's getting close to it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, welcome messenger. Like, okay. He's apostrophizing the wind. What is an apostrophe? Mm. Does anyone know that word?
My students never use them anymore, but that's not
the time. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. So this we're going to come back to.
Not using the English preparation.
It takes me too long to find an apostrophe on their keyboard.
Apostrophe. It's like, it's an oh, wind, oh, earth, oh, welcome messenger. So an invocation. Oh, muse. Oh, muse.
Stroke. So the root of stroke, so up, like apocalyptic, right? To lift or above or again. So stroke from Greek at the root there? You don't know the etymology?
I don't know, but I should find out. That's really interesting.
Huh? If we were in the outside world, you'd just look it up.
Yeah, I know, yeah. That's really great.
Unfortunately, we're not.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it's half conscious, and then he calls it messenger, and he calls it friend. So what is he doing there? A captive greets thee. He's talking to it.
There's a relationship.
There's a relationship. Yeah, he's creating it as a person that he can have a relationship with. Yeah. So in both of these poems, we have conversations, right? So, what do we make of this thing where the wind is also in him? And the very end of that passage we read.
Well, he turns it into the sweet breath of heaven in line 41.
Okay, great. So this hour has brought a gift, great, back to gift that consecrates my joy. For I await me thought, well, the sweet breath of heaven. Great, yeah, so in some ways so biblical, right? And there's biblical resonance through this.
But then felt within a corresponding mild creative breeze, a vital breeze which traveled gently on.
Or things which it had made.
Vexing its own redundant energy.
Yeah.
Vexing its own creation.
It's much more tumultuous inside him than it probably is outside him.
Good question. Yeah, it's a great question. So can you say more about how it's tumultuous inside of him? What does that tumult do? What does it suggest here?
Vernal promises that the ice will melt, the frost will break and bring spring. It's an internal spring, which I take as his creative process to get going.
Yep. Yeah.
He's frozen inside and this wind is going to melt the frost.
Yeah. And is this the creative life, this formative thing that it's going to make its own creation? It had made. It's a creative race. Like, there's so much emphasis on making. Is this his making? As like poet of like this powerful poet, or is it of the outside breeze? Mm-hmm. Whose making is this? Whose force is this?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because he felt within a corresponding mild creative breeze, so it's not obviously the same breeze.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's at a point where you actually realize where you need to go or what you need to do. You feel a sense of like power in a good way, or like centeredness, or like I wonder if. As he struggled along here, he's starting to feel shifts within him, and he just uses the wind for the air, maybe.
Or maybe there is that, in some sense, apprehension of it being the same, even though somewhat different, but that the wind of the earth is the same as, you know, that ruach spirit of God that's outside and inside. And the words you're saying, Peg, of corresponding. Now, does that mean corresponding as in, you know, has a likeness, or does it mean corresponding? As in,
Great question.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's so interesting. Yeah. It's become a tempest, a redundant energy vexing its own creation.
So the little marginal thing suggests that redundant at that time had a different meaning than it does now.
I have to look that up. But sense is that that's one of the marginal, like this is an editor trying to clarify.
Yeah.
When it doesn't, like it's actually really complicated. Like it's actually pretty vexed, that word.
Oh, okay.
Redundant. That's my sense. I didn't look it up in the OED. But I think it's like the editor trying to say, like, yeah, this is how you would interpret this. But I definitely should look. I meant to do that, to look up. Like, I don't. Yeah. Yeah, my sense is that it's really a complex word. Then too.
Yeah.
Because so what does it suggest if it's like redundant, vexing its, because the vexation, it's not just abounding, because there's vexation there at the heart.
Yeah. Well, redundancy is unnecessary. Like there's already something is redundant, well, something that's not necessary because something else is already doing what that thing is doing.
No, it's more like a backup. Like you.
Okay.
Create redundancy in places where there's danger.
Okay.
So, you, like, if like here in the village, we have it, like Elboy, everything we have is redundant, because if it goes out, we're in big trouble. Mm-hmm. If there's no power or if there's no water, so we have redundant systems. And we hope to not use them. We hope that they're just extra, but most often they're used in a situation that is dangerous. So.
Right. Huh. Right.
Yeah.
So that might computer be interesting.
Yeah. It's also used in contemporary English, Great Britain, when someone says, my job was made redundant.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And why do we, in our world right now, where we need to, like, it's a world focused on the economy, focused on, like, jobs become redundant when? Why do jobs become redundant?
Because humans have been replaced by machines.
Okay, humans become redundant, but what's the core? And so what? Like, why wouldn't humans and machines both do the work? Why not?
Because humans are too expensive.
More efficient.
Yes.
Because it's all about cutting down the excess.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And not having, like, it's a linear model.
Mm-hmm.
So here, is this a linear relationship? Mm-hmm. Relationship. A linear model of how energy operates.
Huh.
Yeah, we have the wind outside, we have the wind inside. We can't quite... Like, they're not the same wind. They're not quite the same. We can't just merge them together.
Mm-hmm.
And we also can't quite distinguish them clearly.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like the girl and her siblings in the ground. Are they living? Are they dead?
Yeah.
It doesn't quite fit that logic.
You know, it's
right.
Interesting because English doesn't have, like what Biblical Greek does, a word that covers both.
That's true, yeah.
Like pneuma. So John, Jesus can say to Nicodemus, the pneuma blows where it wills, and you see it's, and does he mean wind or does he mean spirit? Well, you
That's
can't answer
amazing.
That question, because there's one word means both,
wow.
But there's nothing in English that does that.
Right, right, right. And there's a logic of the Enlightenment that Wordsworth is
mm-hmm.
responding to and writing within.
Mm-hmm.
And so according to that logic, this is vexation.
Yeah.
This is vexing.
Now, you're raising an interesting question. I don't know the answer to etymologically. Like, ancient Hebrew, ruach, who Sue used as spirit and wind, and Greek has it. Is English not have it precisely because of the Enlightenment? Because of the separation of reason, you know, from other things?
I think
spirit is not a reason word?
I think that wind has the association of spirit all the way through. Like, I think it continues to have that association.
But you could have secular wind, right? You could just have wind as
totally.
A physical phenomenon
totally.
That says no more than
yeah.
secular wind.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, but in
yeah.
the other languages,
of course.
It's
oh
always
gosh.
Left ambiguous.
I'm going to just tell you that the exercise, so you can do it later,
oh,
is to
fine.
Stand on the road, and we're going to write invocations. So it's this place of movement between and, like, uncertainty and indeterminacy. And so we're going to write an O, like something to, something that you see.
Cool.
So if you want to, if you so choose, later on, yeah.
All right.
Okay, so and let's, on that note, let's shift and do it, yeah.